probably recognize that the colonial is more English than the English, in the sense that he brought up abroad, he's not sophisticated, and he's rather shocked when he comes home by the narrowness and the frigidity of the life of his so-called motherland. But in fact, from a patriotic point of view, one's nationality is one's language. And so long as there is English and the Elizabethans, one cannot step outside it in any way, so long as one creates within that gum, as the French call it. I was born in India. I'm a colonial. I'm really, in literature, I'm a sort of white Negro, in a strange way. First of all, I was not simply a colonial in the sense of an occupier of India. My family had been there since the revolution, and there were six or seven uncles and aunts who had never seen England. We were there for several generations and very well integrated into the life of India. All my family spoke not only Urdu, but many of the variant dialects that they needed for their work. They were, of course, British administrators and extremely British in their attitude and with all the limitations of the British. But at the same time, the fact that they had never seen motherland cut them off a little bit, like you can imagine, perhaps a Roman living in Africa might have children who had never seen Rome, but who were extremely Roman in their attitudes to virtue, to politics, to whatever you like. So we were a little bit exaggeratedly British in an awkward way, and England to us was a sort of shock because it didn't seem open-hearted, gay, and fruitful. We were astonished that it had such enormous power and such political, it controlled such enormous areas of the land surface of the world without having really much more than a local and parochial ethos. We didn't realize that the force of things, as in a dynamo, is condensation. And of course, from the condensation of the English ethos, they made this enormous projection. But of course, it didn't last, and it can't last. But then nothing lasts.
But for instance, as for some German writers, their feeling and what they are writing about Germany is such a mixture of love and hatred. As for your writing about England, you are very skeptical, but there is no such a high temperature of attitude.
No, I regard myself as extremely English. And I regard my job, since I'm working in English, to sort of try and develop the English psyche a little bit, you know, just as Joyce makes that wonderful statement about trying to rejuvenate his race. He's in Paris, after all. He's not in Dublin. We have the same context because the English are Philistines. They need to be re-educated. We're giving them a bouncing.
Judging by your life and your books, the search for place, the awareness of what you have called the spirit of place, is both your purpose and your central theme. But you appear to feel completely at home in the time in which you have spent your life, or does it only seem that way?
No, it's true in the sense, but it's very much, it has been very much wished on me in the sense that the war business started when I was around 22. Had there been no war, I would still be now in the island of Corfu, speaking excellent Greek and thoroughly integrated into Corfu. But starting from that period when I was 22, 1940, I was living in suitcases, one suitcase usually, and being chased like a rat from corner to corner of Europe by warring factions. So that I've learned my refugeedom. I'm a professional refugee. Even here, I could pack essential things in 20 minutes and leave. I am traumatized by travel. I have an old Volkswagen camper there. I can fill that in 20 minutes. I could leave this place and forget it.
At the same time, as for time as an aesthetical category, I think that you have very interesting some development of this notion, I mean your stereoscopic principle of time, so your heroes live at different levels of time. But what I asked you about was not the aesthetical category of time, but just mostly you are writing about the 20th century.
Yes, you see, one can only write about the little that one knows, you know, and one's optic is a very limited one. But in a sense, I have an Indian heart and an English skin. I realized, but very late, when I was 20, 22, when I was writing The Black Book, it created a sort of a psychological crisis. I nearly had a nervous breakdown, which Freud would have enjoyed very much. He would have laughed very much. But it caused me much pain. I realized suddenly that I was not English, really. I was not European. There was something going on underneath, and I realized it was the effect of India on my thinking. And so I became a scientist in the accepted Occidental sense in order to get to the end of science to see where it stopped. I realized that our kind of positivist, materialist attitude, not simply to society, but to the universe, was not very fruitful. And I wondered whether my old yogic intimations from the Indians mightn't have some kind of relation. And in Greece, I happily found my way back to Pythagoras, who was an Indian. And through the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, Heraclitus and company, who had all studied in India, I realized the vital link between Eastern thinking and Western thinking. And now, in this period of wars and difficulties and violent differences about types of society and types of thinking, one thing is very obvious. We are all becoming East-West with the help of information and television. Everybody is now coming to grips with another culture, even visually. So the Tibet is no longer far away. Within the next 50 years, one world of some sort is going to be created. What sort of world will it be? Obviously, the philosophies are going to have to join and make concessions. The extreme materialism and positivism of the West must be modified by the mysticism and the souplesse of Taoism or some other system, which is really quite logical. If you do yoga, you laugh at Christian prayer. What can earth Christian prayer on behalf of Mr. John Brown compared to the meditation systems of the East? And these things are now beginning to operate in the West. So there is one world coming, and that one world will have to have one novel. What sort?
You are writing mostly about the countries or landscapes which are very rich in colors or smells, but I think that there are the epochs, the times, which also are very rich on this sensuous things. The fact that you are writing mostly about our time nowadays, 20th century, does it mean that you find that just our time, the 20th century, is one of the most smelly or colorful or picturesque one?
Yes, it is, because I don't know how difficult it is to describe to you what our situation was pre the war, pre 1940. Travel was not possible. Nowadays, an English bank clerk can spend a fortnight in Peking if he wants. It was not possible before. When I was in Hollywood visiting Henry Miller, six of the top Tibetan lamas arrived on a package tour. This is so inconceivable from myself at the age of 20 that it's a complete revolution. So that, and of course, with the help of the cinema, it's giving us a factitious feel and smell of many landscapes. It's no longer possible to be original about exotic landscapes because everyone has seen them. There is nothing original left now. We have to really think of something original to be original, because everything is available. You press a button and you have it on a screen.
Critics have placed you, so to speak, in the generation of James Joyce. How accurate a placing is this? Do you feel you are isolated from the rest of contemporary English literature?
No, I'm of course much younger than Joyce. I mean, Joyce made me, in a sense. He was my papa, if you like, as he was the papa of all the generation to which I belong.
I'm sorry, but at the same time, for instance, Graham Greene, who is older than you are, but he's not from Joyce's generation. He goes from other origin, from other sources and roots.
Yes, but he's not very important, you see. His Catholicism is pure snobbery, and he's a highly competent and unputdownable writer, raconteur. He's marvelous, but he's definitely minor league.
Yeah, but I mean, my question was just about your feeling of isolation, because not only Graham Greene, but if you take the modern English literature, for instance, the working, the so-called working novel, Osborne or John Wayne and so on and so forth. Abroad, for instance, in the Soviet Union, English literature is represented mostly by them.
And that's not my fault.
Yeah, but do you feel if to take such a trend of English literature, do you feel together with them or completely separated?
I'm feeling different, you know, to them. I love Graham Greene, for example. I said something nasty about him. I read him with great avidity. But when you're speaking about literature, there's a sort of classical difference between the depth and the vibration given off by the big thing and the medium vibration given off by the medium thing. Now, these are charming people who people their epoch like wallpaper people's a bedsitter. It's a very poor epoch, wretched in poverty. They wrote beautiful English. Graham Greene writes a beautiful English. So does Evelyn Waugh, but there's nothing inside. It's nothing inside, pretension and snobbery. John Wayne is a good journalist. I'm sorry for the Russians.
Yeah. We know not only John Wayne, we know also, for instance, William Golding, some of his good novels.
He's a very good Protestant novelist, yes, he's excellent. He's very old-fashioned, excellent, yes.
Yes, but at the same time, although he is good, I feel that your style or your origin as an author, as a writer, is others.
I'm not claiming any originality. I'm interested in other things, you know. I'm interested in another sort of thing. I feel I'm European, really. By my interest, I can't claim anything for my work because until it's finished, one doesn't know what value it has, you know? For me, it's a question of trying a recipe like cookery, but of course you have to serve the meal and it's got to be eatable. And I can't guarantee for the moment that it's eatable. But the line of country that interests me is not that parochialism. You see, it's all terribly parochial. They might as well be Danish people writing in some small Danish island. It's nothing very enlivening. Poor old Snow and company.
And do you feel yourself somehow Irish in the sense that Joyce or Beckett are Irish?
Well, of course that. I have some bastard touch there. Yes, long ago. But I do feel that same sort of thing. Of course, they have every right to feel like that because, as Beckett says, on the one hand they got the Catholics up their arse, and on the other hand they got the British. What can they do but sing?
So, from that point of view, Irish becomes a bit more even aesthetical or literary category, yes, than a national one.
Oh yes, not national at all, because there again it's a ridiculous situation. The British specialize in these situations, Cyprus, Ireland, Palestine, wherever they go, there's some idiotic situation like this. Look at the Falkland farce. Mamma mia, that could have turned very nasty. And here they're all going about with their chest blown out. It's incredible.
Besides prose, you have also published poetry. In Russian literary criticism, there is a semi-scholarly definition of a specific genre, the poet's prose. Would you consider that your travel books and novels might fall under this definition of a poet's prose? I mean, just the attitude towards language and the principle of composition, more associative than plot-like, for instance, or the language as the aim of the writing. Mm.
But then you're in competition so much with bad prose writing about landscape that you have to jazz it up a little bit to make it a little bit more pimenté than an ordinary thing. And also to render things, you have to give yourself a little bit, you run away with yourself. I'm aware that sometimes it's a little bit too juicy, but what can I do to describe it to somebody who has never seen it? You have to a little bit exaggerate to hold their attention. I'm thinking of Lawrence, for example. There's marvelous Twilight in Italy, I reread the other day, and Mornings in Mexico. It's so fresh, it's, the paint is still not dry on it. And it's full of grammatical mistakes, it doesn't matter.
I mean, even, you know, there is such a German word, very comfortable, I think, Dichter, and yes, under this Dichter they fall. In fact, all the powerful writers, for instance, Dostoevsky, although he has never written poetry, but he is a Dichter for Germans. But what I'm asking, it's not just this poetical invasion or poetical power, but something very professional, the attitude towards language. And from that point of view, this Russian definition of a poet's prose, for instance, Marina Tsvetaeva's prose, or mm-hmm. Osip Mandelstam's mm-hmm. prose, they could be treated as poets' prose.
Yes, because you're transcribing insight there, and when you transcribe insight, you can't help but write poetry.
But at the same time, I find that the plot is quite important. It does play a role in your prose, and from that point of view, it's purely already prose.
Perhaps the feeling of being isolated a little bit, and I don't mean now, in France, a feeling a little bit colonial made me more sympathetic to the roots of English thing. I'm mad about the Elizabethans still. I'm still learning from them. And I regarded writing now as a way of defending, because we are now beginning to write like barbarians, Americans.
But among Americans, there are not only barbarians. America is the motherland of William Faulkner, for instance.
Yes, all the Americans brought up in Canada write beautiful English.
Even Salbello.
He brought up in Canada.
That's he was.
Yes. I was thinking of
okay.
He writes beautiful English.
Yes. In your travel sketches, you have written very penetratingly about all sorts of people, Cypriots, Greeks, and so on. Was your experience in the colonies, your upbringing in India, a help in this respect?
No, because when I was in India, I didn't question either our right to be there or anything else. I mean, I thought God had sent us there to help them, you know, like the Russians in Afghanistan. We thought that we'd just been sent there to show them civilization and morally educate them. It was only with a shock we discovered that they had a religion superior to ours, and that this huge subcontinent had something quite different. And there we made the one honest political decision that the English have ever made. We got out. And thank God we won India that way. I mean, we won the soul of India by that thing. Now, in Greece, we did the same thing in Corfu. We got out of those seven islands. When you go there now, you will be embraced if you say you're English automatically. But if you go to Cyprus, they'll spit.